The number of uninsured children is rising nationwide. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway on October 23rd, why children are losing their coverage and parents are getting caught by surprise. Also on the show, gun sales are thriving online and presenting a loophole to federal background checks.
A site like armslist.com is designed to facilitate firearm sales. And it's a site with, based on our research, that is huge, and it's dangerous, and it's deadly.
And diversity initiatives in the workplace might look good on paper, but they're rarely seeing real results.
Sometimes chief diversity officers don't even have access to internal company data that would allow them to kind of identify where there might be problems as well as opportunities for intervention.
Let's start with insurance and why kids are losing their coverage. For low-income families and vulnerable communities, having children who don't have health insurance is a daunting reality. While millions of children in the United States get their health insurance through the federal government under Medicaid and CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, that coverage is not guaranteed. A new report from the New York Times shows that since December 2017, more than 1 million children have lost their health insurance coverage under Medicaid and CHIP. And in that same time, the number of uninsured children has gone up by 400,000.
They're finding this out when they're showing up to the doctor's office or trying to follow up on care.
That's Laura Guerra-Cardas, deputy director at the Children's Defense Fund, Texas. And she told a Takeaway about one Texas family that unknowingly lost their coverage for their children.
In this family's case, they were trying to make an appointment for physical therapy for their child, who without it is unable to walk properly if he doesn't get that care. And despite being an incredibly diligent family and following up, it still took 3 months to get her child back on healthcare coverage.
The family story is hardly an isolated case, and the absence of preventative care for children can have long-lasting health effects, and it can also launch families into a downward spiral of debt. I'm joined now by Margot Sanger-Katz, healthcare reporter for The New York Times. She co-wrote the piece for The Times. Margot, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're also joined by Joan Alker, executive director of the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. And for years, Joan has been tracking children's health insurance coverage. Joan, thanks for being with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Margot, how dramatic has the rise in uninsured children actually been in your based on your reporting?
So I wouldn't describe it as a huge increase, but it is pretty remarkable in the sense that it's the reversal of a very long-standing trend. So really, for decades, we've seen uninsurance among children declining as more and more kids are getting coverage through various sources. And then since 2016, we've seen kind of 2 years in a row in which children's coverage has declined. So it's, I think, a worrying sign because of the direction of it. We're not seeing absolutely huge increases in the number of children without insurance, but we do know from a lot of sources that when children don't have health insurance, that can have really cascading effects, long-term effects in not just their health, but also things like educational attainment and their lifetime earnings.
Joan, give us a sense of why these numbers are on the rise. They were on the decline for a while, and now all of a sudden in the past 2 years, we've seen this increase in more uninsured children.
That's right. As Margot said, we've seen a decline in this country, something that really I think we could all be proud of for many, many years. And it predated the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, began to be implemented in 2014 as a result of the expansions of the Medicaid program and the establishment of the Children's Health Insurance Program. But as Margot said, come 2016, which was actually our lowest rate of uninsured kids ever, that started to turn around, and that's what we see today. So we attribute that to, I'd say, three main points. The first is that there's a real chilling effect right now because of the hostile actions of the Trump administration towards immigrant families. We have many children in this country who the child may be a citizen, but the parent may be an immigrant. Those parents are understandably fearful of interacting with government right now, signing their kids up for a program like Medicaid, even if they're eligible. Secondly, we saw, particularly in 2017, families were hearing all year long that Congress was cutting health coverage. They were cutting Medicaid. They were trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Even today, we have the court maybe striking down parts of the Affordable Care Act. And then Congress failed to extend the Children's Health Insurance Program for many months. Families, again, were hearing coverage might be taken away. At the same time, resources were cut for community-based navigators and outreach programs. So that's another problem, we think, as to why these trends are occurring. And then lastly, we're seeing, as Margot's great reporting indicated, some real increases in what we call red tape at the state level, and some states in particular. And those are creating barriers for families to enroll and retain their kids' coverage.
Margot, what is the Trump administration saying about this? How do they explain the rising number of uninsured kids?
So the main explanation that the Trump administration has, and indeed the main explanation for most of the states where the largest decreases in kids, CHIP, and Medicaid coverage are occurring, is the same. And that's, we have a growing economy, and as more and more families are lifted out of poverty and have better paying jobs, they are kind of graduating out of these public programs that are designed for low-income families and into employer-sponsored insurance. And so we shouldn't see these reductions in coverage in these public programs as a bad thing. We should see it as a good thing, as a sign that people are getting better jobs. But the data about the increases in the uninsured rate among children suggests that while that may be a true story for some of these kids, it doesn't seem to explain all of the reductions.
And Margot, what about migrant communities and immigrant families? What's the unique case situation that they find themselves in right now?
So I think it's actually quite hard to measure exactly what the effect of this sort of chilling rate that Joan described may be. But we do see my colleague Abby Goodenough, who worked on the story with me, spent some time in Houston, Texas, and she was talking with families and with healthcare providers who take care of this low-income community. And she spoke with one mother who is, in fact, a legal immigrant. She has permanent status and a green card, but she's so afraid of something that might interfere with her ability to stay in the United States that she had disenrolled her children from Medicaid. So there, her children are both citizens. They had been enrolled in Medicaid for a long time. And one of them indeed had asthma that required medication to be properly managed. But she was so scared that she might have her immigration status be interfered with, that she might get separated from her children, that she pulled her kids out of the program. So we sort of hear anecdotally from families and from folks who are close to these communities that that is happening around the country in certain states where there are a lot of immigrants. We're seeing some reductions in enrollment among those families.
Joan, sort of taking a look at the political roots here, I mean, healthcare is once again defining the presidential race, particularly when we hear Democratic candidates talking about it. We've even heard some Republicans, including Mitt Romney, who are opposed to the idea of free universal healthcare because it would create what he calls a magnet, incentivizing more families to come to the United States. Is that accurate to say, Joan?
Well, we're talking about children today, and for children, the reality is most of those kids are eligible for coverage today. They just may not be enrolled or their coverage has lapsed. And this, again, as I said, really predated the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act really helped drive down children's uninsured rates to the lowest level we've ever seen, and 95% of children are covered. So with respect to children, there is a small number of undocumented children who don't have a path to coverage, but most do. So when you're talking about kids, the name of the game is making sure that those kids are getting matched up with their proper source of coverage, Medicaid, CHIP, or the new ACA marketplaces. So that's really not much of an issue here.
But when it comes to immigration policy, I think Mitt Romney's basically saying that if we have this type of universal health care, it's going to incentivize more immigrant families to come to the United States. Is our immigration policy connected to health insurance benefits for children?
I really don't think so, no. We have very few children who are immigrants who are on these programs. There are a small number, but the vast, vast majority of these kids are in what we call mixed status families, where the parent may be an immigrant, but the child is a citizen.
Margot, Joan mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and I'm wondering if there were any safeguards in the Affordable Care Act to prevent what we're seeing from happening.
So it's actually interesting. There's some irony here because what the Affordable Care Act did is it tried to simplify the ways that states evaluated who was eligible for Medicaid. So it used to be kind of a complicated process in some states where people would have to go into a welfare office in person and provide all kinds of documents about their assets, about their income, and other things. And what the Affordable Care Act basically said was, we're going to have an income threshold. If you earn less than a certain income, then your child is going to be eligible for the program. And the federal government gave states a lot of money to update their computer systems to help so that they might be able to access access data from other programs. Maybe if the family was enrolled in food assistance or in housing assistance, they might be able to match and say, oh, we know this family is eligible for Medicaid. We already know what their income is. Let's just sign them right up. It also allows states to match up data with some state payroll systems. So it was a way to kind of streamline enrollment, make it less burdensome for families to sign up. But what's happened in some states is that the transition from really old kind of antique computer systems that were used to sign up families for Medicaid to these newer systems has been really problematic. And there have been a lot of failures and a lot of errors. And it has made the system more automated so that when there's an error, often what happens is that a family kind of just automatically gets kicked out of the program. And so that sort of thing has been happening in a couple of states, including Tennessee and Missouri, where really large numbers of children lost coverage over a very short period of time, due in part to these kind of computer update problems. Another thing that's happened, and we see this in some states, including Texas and Arkansas, is that now that states have this ability to match up using the computer, they start checking all the time. So instead of just having a family renew their coverage once a year or twice a year, which is the way it was before the Affordable Care Act, what these computer systems can do is they can look every month, do we have any evidence that this family's income may have risen to a point where it might be too high for them to be eligible for Medicaid? And so, again, Abby in Houston spoke with a family there where what happened is the computer system thought that the mother had earned too much in 1 month, sent her a letter and gave her only 10 days to write back and prove that her income was still low enough to qualify for Medicaid. It turned out that actually it was, but she didn't get the letter, she wasn't able to respond quickly enough. And by the time she found out what had happened, her coverage had been canceled and she was, you know, at the emergency room with a sick baby and no coverage.
Joan, a lot of the kids that are affected under these current changes are under the age of 6, from what we understand. What are the long-term effects of children missing out on health care?
Well, as any parent of a young child knows, you're at the doctor all the time. There are frequent screenings, immunizations, and other things that are critical. And we know that brain development is extremely rapid in the period 0 to 3. So it's really important to catch those kinds of developmental issues early on. So this is a serious problem. I do want to just make one larger point, though, which is, you know, Margo's talking about there are a lot of state-by-state details here with respect to how the enrollment systems are working. But I think we need to keep our eye on a bigger point, which is no one is minding the store here. The Trump administration, instead of being concerned about the fact the number of uninsured kids is going up on their watch for the first time in many years, really ever since we began looking at this issue, has not even acknowledged that this is a problem. And it is really their duty, because ultimately they're responsible. The majority of the dollars for the Medicaid program are federal dollars. They're responsible for taking a look at what's going on in many states around the country and trying to reverse this situation.
Joan Alker is the executive director of the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, and Margo Sanger-Katz is a healthcare reporter for the New York Times. Margo, Joan, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Even as congressional action on gun safety continues to stall, polling has shown that Americans broadly support universal background checks. And while there's a lot of attention on how loopholes in background check laws can make it easy to get a gun through a private sale at a gun show, unregulated gun sales also thrive online. Greg Bessinger is a reporter at The Washington Post, and after a series of mass shootings this summer, he went online to see how easy it would be to find gun parts and accessories.
I just went to Amazon and I went to Google and looked on their websites to see what I could find there. And sure enough, it was very easy to find gun parts and gun ammunition on these websites. I went to these companies' privacy policies to look up what they wouldn't allow on their websites for sale. And those became valuable terms for me to use to find the very things that were banned. Things like high capacity magazines, shotgun shells, full guns and gun parts, things that you could make an arsenal out of if you really were motivated.
This is not a new problem for big tech companies. People have been flagging online gun sales for years.
Mike Montero, a web designer in San Francisco, said that he reported hundreds of gun sales to Facebook back in 2016 after the company said it was banning gun sales on its platform.
So we went on Facebook and we looked for guns for sale, and we got a ton of results. They were all there, and they were private gun sales. There were a bunch of guns right out in the open being sold as guns. But another thing that we found was you'd see an ad with like a gun on a table next to a Coke can, and it would say like, for sale, Coke can, $950, includes everything on table. And we reported them. And more often than not, we eventually get a report back saying, no, this is actually okay.
Greg Bessinger of The Washington Post says it really shouldn't be hard to stop this problem, at least not for big tech.
It really is as simple as putting a flag in the system that says these kind of search terms shouldn't lead to a product that is banned by our privacy policy. These are supposed to be the most sophisticated companies in the world, their technology. How could it not catch items like this that I found in just minutes?
Rob Wilcox is with me to talk about all this, and he's the Deputy Director of Policy and Strategy at Everytown for Gun Safety. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm pleased to be here with you.
So where are most of these online gun sales happening?
Well, we took a look at one significant website called armslist.com, which says that it's the largest free gun classifieds site on the web. And it's a website that allows users to post ads for firearms. And those ads will include a picture, a description, a price, and the location where the sale can be made. And we found this to be a significant part of the online firearms marketplace.
How does ArmsList work for people who want to buy guns and people who want to sell them?
So it operates similarly to other online classified platforms, where a seller posts an ad with a picture, a description, the location of where the firearm could be purchased. And then a user goes online, goes to armslist.com, and they're able to connect over text message or email so that you can finalize the transaction.
What about other sites beyond ArmsList? We heard at the top of the segment here, Greg Bessinger, reporter at The Washington Post, talking about Amazon. We heard someone else talking about Facebook. Is it still possible to go to these sites and buy guns?
So those are examples of sites that people are trying to evade their privacy policy. A site like armslist.com is designed to facilitate firearm sales. And it's a site with, based on our research, that is huge, and it's dangerous, and it's deadly. We found that there were over 1.2 million posts for firearm sales that would not require a background check on armslist.com.
What kind of federal and state laws exist around buying and selling guns online? Does it matter if it's on Facebook versus armslist.com, or what are the laws?
Well, it's a great question. And the reason we undertook this project is because we know there's a loophole in the federal law. If you're a licensed gun dealer, well, you have to do a background check when you sell a gun. And that background check will look for federal prohibitors. Are you a felon, a domestic abuser, a fugitive, a drug abuser? But the loophole is that if you're an unlicensed seller, a private party, well, then you can sell a gun without a background check. And a site like armslist.com allows perfect strangers to connect. And what we found, sales to be completed in less than 3 minutes of face-to-face time.
What's the difference in buying a gun from an unlicensed seller versus a licensed seller?
The way that they describe it is really plain and straightforward. There was one seller in Georgia who our investigator asked how we're going to complete the sale. And this unlicensed seller just said it's like selling a pair of shoes or something. In Tennessee, we asked another seller, how are we going to complete this sale? And he said it's just like newspaper classifieds, but without the paper. Just come up with a time and place to meet, and I'll take your word that you're eligible. These are sales without background checks, and so people who are prohibited know that they can go on armslist.com and find a seller, complete a sale, and no one will be the wiser.
Rob, who are the people who are buying guns on ArmsList?
Well, disproportionately, it's people who would fail a background check. Now, there's plenty of hobbyists and sportsmen who are using ArmsList, but what we found is that the rate of prohibited buyer is much, much higher online than it is at gun stores. We had investigators post ads on armslist.com. Individuals would respond to them when we would do public records requests. What we found is that there was an incredibly high rate of prohibited purchasers trying to buy guns. 1 in 9 of people looking online to buy guns from unlicensed sellers were prohibited. And they were prohibited for really, really scary and dangerous reasons. They had violent felonies, They were convicted of misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence. They were drug abusers, or they had active protective orders against them. In some cases, they were under 18. I think about one ad in particular where we placed a High Point handgun for sale in Georgia, and we got a response by a text message for that advertisement. And this individual said he wanted to buy that firearm within a day. Well, a public records request showed multiple prohibitions. He was convicted for a felony for child molestation, a felony for threatening to commit aggravated assault, the use of methamphetamines, and he was currently under indictment for failing to register as a sex offender. And this was someone who was looking to get a gun within 24 hours. And in a state like Georgia, where this ad was placed, well, there'd be no background check to find out any of those things.
Is the Arms List website or any other online gun marketplace or any other site, including social media, where people might be able to purchase guns online, are they liable for the sales that take place on their platform?
No, they're protected under a different federal law. And so they take a hands-off approach to these transactions. And the truth is, these transactions have tragic results. This isn't just a loophole on paper. It's one that is impacting Americans all the time. I think about a woman named Zena Daniel from Wisconsin. She took out a protective order on her abusive husband. He had a history of abusing her. And that protective order prohibited him from buying a firearm. But he knew he would fail that background check, and so he didn't go to a gun store. He went to armslist.com. He bought a handgun in a parking lot of a McDonald's. And the next day he went to Zena's office, her spa where she worked, and he killed her. And he killed two other women, and he injured four others. And that's just one example. There's countless more. One of the recent mass shootings this summer in West Texas was conducted by a shooter who had failed a background check when he tried to buy a gun from a gun store. And then he was able to meet someone and then conduct a private sale where there was no background check.
Rob, is there anything being done in Congress that would address this loophole? I feel like we've been talking about the loophole here for years. Where does it stand at the congressional level right now?
We're seeing tremendous action and leadership from the House of Representatives. A bipartisan bill passed that would require background checks on all gun sales. But it's sitting on Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's desk. And his inaction is costing lives every single day.
Rob Wilcox is Deputy Director of Policy and Strategy at Everytown for Gun Safety. Rob, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Diversity is a booming business. Organizations across the country are turning to diversity and inclusion initiatives, or D&Is, to chip away at inequity in the workplace. And they're spending billions of dollars on everything from commissioning studies and task forces to recruiting consultants to hold anti-bias trainings. And many companies are also creating new roles tasked with improving diversity, like chief diversity officers. In 2018, the job site Indeed reported that online job postings for diversity and inclusion professionals had increased 35% since 2016. But while the business of diversity is growing, diversity itself is not. Many groups remain underrepresented across industries and particularly in leadership positions. And joining me now to talk through the scope and the limits of diversity in the business of it is Pamela Newkirk, journalist and author of the new book, Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. Pamela, thanks for being with us.
Such a pleasure.
So let's start with the basics. We hear a lot about diversity. We hear a lot about inclusion. They're not the same thing. What is the difference between the two?
Well, diversity is having, I guess, representation of different groups in the workplace. Inclusion is making them feel like they belong to those institutions.
Two very different things. I want to get into how those kind of, you know, shake out.
Right.
Now, we mentioned a lot about diversity initiatives. We're seeing it's this billion-dollar industry. But why are we seeing so much money invested in this right now?
Well, that was the question that led me to my book. I wanted to look at this tension between the rhetoric around diversity and the billions of dollars that are spent and the fact that the numbers are not substantially changing, particularly in many of our most elite fields. I'm thinking academia, law, museums, you know, the arts in general, Hollywood. Academe. So why are we investing so much to get so little?
And so why are we? I mean, are companies just feeling like they have to do this now? Are they feeling like, okay, we've got to check this box in order to look like we're doing something?
Right. Well, I really can't get into the heads of the institution leaders who are doing this, but when you keep doing the same thing and expect different results, then maybe you need to step back and interrogate what it is that you're doing.
So let's talk about the goal here. I mean, we mentioned all types of things that companies are doing. They're bias training, they're, you know, trying to make more efforts to change. Are we talking about optics, Pamela, or are we talking about real change? And what I mean by real change is hiring people into senior positions, right? Or are we just talking about covering the company?
Well, it does appear in many instances companies seem more concerned about the public relations around diversity than you know, social justice. We do see that when there are embarrassing missteps or revelations of exclusion, homogenous workplaces or boards, that's when we all of a sudden see these high-profile initiatives. And then if you check in a year or two later, you haven't really seen much activity in the numbers, you know. So I'm focusing on the actual metrics, and they're just not moving.
So oftentimes we say, you know, one of the things that a lot of folks, when they talk about diversity in the workplace in particular, is that we say it's good for business, right? But I want to unpack that a little, because that also feels like a double-edged sword. I mean, it feels like, you know, should we be valuing quote-unquote diverse employees just because they're, you know, good for the bottom line? And are we doing that for non-diverse employees? Like, how does that really play out?
Right. I think there was a period during which the bottom line argument was made because nothing else was working. Mm-hmm. So there was this theory, if you tell companies that it's going to help your bottom line, and it may indeed do that, that there would at least be that economic incentive to achieve diversity. But not even that has worked in many instances. But the good news is that there are models. There are models that companies can replicate. You don't have to recreate the wheel to make this work. Diversity, it requires intention. But it also, in goodwill, I mean, you have to really be serious about this thing. I interviewed Columbia University President Lee Bollinger, and as he says, this doesn't happen by accident. It happens because you lean into it. And it's not something that you can just do by fiat. I mean, it takes a lot of unpacking, as you say, because it's a multi-layered problem.
So let's talk about that, because I was tweeting about this the other day, and one of the things I said that got a lot of attention was, you know, don't tell particularly journalists of color that you're hiring them or us because you need to diversify.
Precisely.
But then how do you do it, right? Because there's a balance between making someone feel like they've only been hired because the company or the organization wants to fulfill its diversity mission.
Right.
And then not doing it. So how do you balance that?
Well, that's the lack of goodwill. That's doing it for a reason other than just equity, inclusion, justice. Do we live in a fair society or not? Are we excluding people because of their race, or are we including people because we want to be smarter? We want that insight that only can come from having that kind of diverse operation. And I think what often happens is it's viewed as a check a box, you know, we'll get this person in. And then that triggers resentment in the newsroom because, oh, you got your job because why'd you get your job? And so there's always this suspicion around hiring people of color. And this taps into centuries of demeaning stereotypes about people of color. It taps into a well of what it means to live to be in an institution that is excellent. What does excellence look like?
And also the idea that, you know, we're only here because, you know, we have to be here because some optics are necessary, or, you know, we're here on some charity initiative.
Not because it makes us smarter, because it makes us better.
Or not because we're smarter and better.
Precisely.
Right? And so we've got less than a minute left. Is there anything that can be done, you think?
Well, one of the chapters that I deal with in the book is looking at Coca-Cola and how over 5 years it really focused on this issue after, of course, it was sued for discrimination and it settled a landmark bias lawsuit. And what they did is they examined the metrics across the workplace. They looked at job categories. They looked at salaries, bonuses, who was being hired, what did the candidate pool look like. And over time, they were able to both detect and disrupt patterns of disparities, patterns of bias.
Pamela Newkirk is a journalist and the author of Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. Pamela, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.